And so I think a lot of it is just acceptance. And emotional sobriety has been said in a lot of different ways. And, I mean, we talk about the buzzword that everybody hates, codependency. You know, what is that other than, you know, codependency is all about our emotions and how we deal with them. So I'd like to just call it emotional sobriety because that's what it is to me. And I can leave out all the psychobabble words because I don't need psychobabble. And I'm just, you know, I need to keep things in very simple, you know, terms, very layman simple terms. So I'm calling it just what Bill called it, emotional sobriety. And I think that he was talking about it years ago. So it's not new, in my opinion. If this is, all the movement we're hearing is not new. Bill wrote this letter in 1958. So it's not new. Those adolescent urges that so many of us have for top approval, perfect security, and perfect romance. Urges quite appropriate to age 17 prove to be an impossible way of life when we are 47 or 57. And I don't know if any of you can identify with that, but I'm here to tell you on any given day I can stand and stomp my feet and have a total temper tantrum without any problem. And I'm certainly in that age of 47 to 57. And I can have that, I want it now, you know, I don't want it later, I want it now. This delayed, you know, the thing they call delayed gratification. Delayed gratification, I have absolutely, that is the hardest thing in the world for me to wait, be patient, work for it. You know, I want to be a brain surgeon, but I don't want to go to school. That's the kind of person I am. You know, I want all the bennies, but I don't want to pay the price. And that's a lot of what I've had to deal with. I've had to learn if you want an education, you got to go to school. And lots of times I'm not willing to do the things that that other people do just to, you know, one day at a time. They go get educated one day at a time. It takes time to do things, and I want it now. And I have realized that what that kind of behavior is very childish. And I've had a hard time growing up. And I think what's so marvelous is the people in Alcoholics Anonymous who get here who are pretty age-appropriate. I was, last weekend when I was in Baltimore, Maryland, I was hosted by a lady who is 22 years old, and she had 8 years of sobriety. Now, you know, when you get sober at that, at what, 15 years old, at least you're somewhat age-appropriate. I got sober at 36 and found out I was this 13-year-old running around in this old body. You know, that was about what my mentality was. That was about what my emotional growth was. Since AA began, I have taken immense wallops in all of these areas because of my failure to grow up emotionally and spiritually. My God, how painful it is to keep demanding the impossible, and how very painful to discover finally that all along we have had the cart before the horse. Then comes the final agony of seeing how awfully wrong we have been, but still finding ourselves unable to get off the emotional merry-go-round. How to translate a right mental conviction into a right emotional result, and so into easy, happy, and good living. Well, that's not only the neurotic's problem, it's the problem of life itself, for all of us who have got to the point of real willingness to hold to right principles in all our affairs. Even then, as we hoe away, peace and joy will still elude us. That's the place so many of us AA olders have come to. And it's a hell of a spot, literally. How shall our unconscious, from which so many of our fears, compulsions, and phony aspirations still stream, be brought into the line with what we actually believe, know, and want? How to Convince Our Dumb, Raging, and Hidden Mr. Hyde becomes our main task. There's like, for me as I understand this, there's like mentally, intellectually, I know this is the way it ought to be. You know, that big ought to, should, all those little, those words that just drive a person like me crazy. You know, you tell me I have to do it, you know, you have to go north and I'm going to go south to just prove it to you. That rage inside of me, that just, this emotional turmoil, yet intellectually I know what's right. But I have this inside conflict going on. This little kid that wants to rebel and not do what I'm supposed to do, or supposed to, I hate that word, would do what's good for me, what will make me happy. But it's just like I just have to rebel, like a little kid, like an adolescent. What's the worst thing about those of us who have adolescents? Doesn't matter what you tell them, they're not going to do it. And, you know, that's appropriate if you're 15, but it becomes very inappropriate if you're 52. And those are the kind of things I'm having to see about myself, is that I am not mature emotionally. My head knows what to do, but my insides have a hard time catching up with my head. I've recently come to believe that this can be achieved. I believe so because I began to see my benighted ones, folks like you and me, commencing to get results. Last autumn, depression, having no really rational cause at all, almost took me to the cleaners. And I guess the reason I have had a lot of identification with Bill, and I know that a lot of people have some problems sometimes with Bill and the things that he did because of depression, is because I am a person that has suffered from depression. Now, not everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous has depression. I happen to be a person who can definitely identify with Bill, doing everything the big book says to do, doing the steps, the very best you can do it, and still believing without a doubt that suicide is an option. Now, drinking ceased to be an option a long time ago, but I still had those feelings of the world would be better off without me. And that selfish, self-centered feeling of, and you know, I've come to believe that when I take actions like that, my actions do affect other people. And the actions I take do hurt other people. And I've had to start to take responsibility for that. And I never, ever wanted to do that. I just felt like the world would be better off without me, and I truly believed that. And I just had this little immature feeling. So I knew about depression, and I began to like to hear what Bill talked about. I started reading about Bill's life to find out how did he overcome depression. And I began to learn some things through reading his readings about what he did. I began to get scared that I was in for another long, chronic spell. And if anybody has depression, know that it's coming on. You know the hole that you're about to go into. And it's like, oh, my God, I can't go there. And you fight it, and you fight it, and you fight it. And it's like, you know, if I go in there, I know that I'm not going to be able to get out. And it's just like, you know, the cat that's holding on with his claws. And if I dare let go, yet the thing that I need to do is let go, but I'm afraid to let go. It's that conflict within myself. Considering the grief I had had with depressions, it wasn't a bright prospect. I kept asking myself, why can't the 12 steps work to release depression? By the hour, I stared at the St. Francis prayer. It's better to comfort than to be comforted. Here was the formula, all right, but why didn't it work? Suddenly, I realized what the matter was. My basic flaw had always been dependence, almost absolute dependence on people or circumstances to supply me with prestige, security, and the like. Finally, to get to these things according to my perfectionist dreams and specifications, I had fought for them, and when defeat came, so did my depression. And I had some answers for me. because I have absolutely been addicted to approval. And I was the kind of person that would go and do nice things for you. But the problem was, is I had an expectation on what I was doing. I wanted you to appreciate me, and I wanted you to tell me what a great person I wasn't. And if you didn't do those things, then I felt like you had rejected me, and I became angry and resentful that you don't appreciate me. Look what I've done for you, and you don't appreciate anything. And I began to take on those feelings, because what I had was a dependency and an expectation on how you were supposed to react to the good things I did for you. So what I began to see about me was I was the person in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that they talk about, manipulation through kindness. I would manipulate you through my kindness so that you would validate my very existence. And I had a dependency on an expectation on your reaction to what you for what I did for you. And if you didn't react the way I expected you to, I became resentful and angry, and depression, the definition of depression is anger turned inward. And I turned the anger inward. Nobody loves me. Nobody likes me. Look what I do for you, and I'm never appreciated. And on and on and on. And the hole gets deeper and deeper and deeper. Okay, da-da-da-da. Failing to get these things according to my perfections and defeat came, I so did my depression. Okay, I read that. There wasn't a chance of making the outgoing love of St. Francis a workable and joyous way of life until these fatal and almost absolute dependencies were cut away. Because I had over the years undergone a little spiritual development, the absolute qualities of these frightful dependencies had never before been so starkly revealed. Reinforced by what grace I could secure in prayer, I found I had to exert every ounce of will and action to cut off these fatal emotional dependencies upon people, upon AA, indeed upon a set of circumstances whatsoever. Whatever I was dependent upon, I had to begin to see that I had to be able to do it for fun and for free. Even AA. And I don't know about any of you. I mean, I know how selfish and self-centered I am. But when I first came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was one of these people who so desperately needed to be approved of that I was doing all these jobs in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, you guys just didn't appreciate me. You just were not giving me the appreciation that I thought I deserved. Doing all this stuff. I'm the one who's doing, you know, planning this thing and that thing, and if there's going to be a potluck, I'm doing it. I mean, it was just full of I. Look what I'm doing. If I want to do those things, I better be willing to do it for fun and for free. Because if I'm not, and I have an expectation on it, I am doomed to fall into that dependency, and that dependency will create depression for me. Now, I don't know what it does for you, but that's what it does for me. And I would do that even in AA. I wasn't coming to Alcoholics Anonymous to get recovery. I was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous in the beginning to get approval. Look how good I'm doing. Tell me how good my program's going. Now, I'm here to tell you, folks, I didn't learn this about myself like in the first years of sobriety. This is 9 years into recovery. I had all these wonderful revelations. And then if you have these kind of revelations at 9 years of sobriety, then there comes a lot of shame and humility. My God, I'm 9 years sober. I ought to know better than this. But maybe that's where I had to be 9 years sober in order to face these kind of things about myself. Because, you know, when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, the glaring things were easy. But as the more sober I got to see those dark little crannies that live way down deep in my soul. And those were the things that were totally shameful. Those dark thoughts and those dark places that are inside of me. I didn't really want you to see that. But I also knew that if I ever wanted to get better, I had to let you see that. Then only could I be free to love as St. Francis had. Emotionally, instinctual satisfactions I saw were really the extra dividends of having love, offering love, and expressing love appropriate to each relationship of life. Plainly, I could not avail myself of God's love until I was able to offer it back to Him by loving others as He would have me. And I couldn't possibly do that so long as I was victimized by false dependencies. You know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that all I have to do is be of maximum service to God and others. It doesn't say a thing in the world that I get rich, I find the love of my life, you know, I find the job that I want. It says that I am to be of maximum service to God and others. And if I'll do that, I'll find happiness. But see, somehow or another, I always thought if I find the right man and he's got plenty of money and he's got a big house and I don't have to work and do all this stuff, I'm going to be happy. And it was kind of like the song used to say, I was just always looking for love in the wrong places. I didn't realize that that feeling of fulfillment was going to come from within, and that was going to come from a relationship with a higher power. And how I was going to get that relationship with the higher power was to be of maximum service to you and others. I mean, it's the total opposite thing in my belief that we're trying to hear about in a lot of therapies today. A lot of therapies, it's about do it for yourself, do it for me, you're the most important person. Well, you know, that whole me syndrome got me a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what got me here. So I've had to realize that by taking care of myself and by being good to myself is being willing to listen to how you are. Because the more time I spend inside of me and wanting to get my expectations met, the more miserable I become. And it became kind of like a paradox for me. And that the reason that, and it's not necessary that I don't want good things for myself, because I do. I do want good things for myself. But what I realized is that if I look at you and want good things for you and put my energy out into the universe, then the energy comes back to me. Just like I learned when I was in that Baptist Sunday school, and I never, ever got it. Because when I put energy out into the universe and I wish good things and nice things for you, what happens is I turn around and get it back tenfold. And I never understood spiritual healing. I didn't understand that. So there may be a lot of controversy with that. And if there is, great. That's what a workshop is all about, is everybody to express what they feel and they believe. I am not the authority. I am just a member of Alcoholics Anonymous standing up here expressing how I feel and what my values and what my beliefs are. But my goodness, folks, you have yours. So that's what, you know, that's what we're here to learn about. Because I bet half this room has a lot more, you know, sobriety than me and more experience, strength, and hope that I have. And what we need is to share it with each other. This is just a point of view. And there's a lot of controversy around what a lot of Bill's thinking. So, and I like to bring that to the table, because what happens is that's how we learn. You know, I'm not into guruism. I think a lot of times that's what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're always looking for the right person to give the right answer. And where the right answer is in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in your relationship with God, that's the right answer. It's not in another human being. Because if a person's in Alcoholics Anonymous, they didn't get here because they were sitting on a park bench singing Jesus Loves Me. That's not how they got here. So I have to remember that each and every one of us are sick puppies, or we wouldn't be here. For my dependency meant demand, a demand for the possession and control of the people and the conditions surrounding me. And I realized that. I had this smile. And gosh, I mean, what an actor. The book talks about us being actors. I used to be, when I was a young girl, they would call me Sweet Polly. And that's what I let you see. But I had this thing going on inside of me. Because, see, I needed to be sweet to you so that you would validate my very existence. So I had an ulterior motive for being nice to you. I had a demand on you. And I had to go and take a look at me and to see that that's what I was doing. And I had to learn to find a way to be honest within myself. And the only way I knew how to do that was to just tell the truth. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, know the truth and the truth will set you free. Now, I don't know about you women, but I can guarantee you a lot of times the truth has pissed me off first. So it may set me free. While those words, absolute dependency, may look like a gimmick, they were the ones that helped to trigger my release into my present degree of stability and quietness of mind, qualities which I am now trying to consolidate by offering love to others regardless of the return to me. And that's the kicker, because I was kind of one of these people that I'll love you if you'll love me back. I'll do that if you'll do this. And I may not say that to you, but that's what was going on inside of me. And if I did something nice to you, I never forgot it until you did it back to me. In my head, you were beholding to me. I may never tell you because sweet Polly would never be honest enough to say that, but I would hold it inside and I would resent it. And walk around about how unappreciative you are. And then this anger may go out and I would do it in ugly gossip about you to other people. And I would just do ugly things and I would sideways hurt you. This seems to be the primary healing circuit. Wait a minute, did I forget? Am I on? Okay. This seems to be the primary healing circuit, an outgoing love of God's creation and His people, by means of which we avail ourselves of His love for us. It is most clear that the real current can't flow until our paralyzing dependencies are broken and broken at depth. Only then can we possibly have a glimmer of what adult love really is. Spiritual calculus, you say. Not a bit of it. Watch any AA of 6 months working with a new 12-step case. If the case says to devil with you, the 12-stepper only smiles and turns to another case. He doesn't feel frustrated or rejection. If his next case depends and it responds and it turns and in turn starts to give love and attention to other alcoholics, yet gives none back to him, the sponsor is happy about it anyway. He still doesn't feel rejected, and still he rejoices that this one-time prospect is sober and happy. And if his next case turns out in later time to be the best friend or romance, then the sponsor is most joyful. But he well knows that his happiness is a byproduct, the extra dividend of giving without any demand for a return. The really stabilizing thing for him was having an offering love to that strange drunk on his doorstep. That was Saint Francis at work, powerful and practical, minus dependency and minus demand. The first 6 months of my sobriety, I worked hard with many alcoholics. Not a one responded. Yet this work kept me sober. It wasn't a question of those alcoholics giving me anything. My stability came out of trying to give, not of demanding that I receive. Thus, I think it can work out with emotional sobriety. If we examine every disturbance we have, great or small, we will find out at the root of it some unhealthy demand. Let us, with God's help, continually surrender these hobbling demands. Then we can be set free to live and love. We may then be able to 12-step ourselves and others into emotional sobriety. Of course, I haven't offered you a really new idea, only a gimmick that has started to unhook several of my own hexes at depth Nowadays, my brain no longer races compulsively in either elation, grandiosity, or depression. I have been given a quiet place in the bright sunshine. And that's what I have begun to take a look at. Along about 9 years of sobriety, I have, as Julia says, she constantly reminds me of what a wonderful man I'm married to. And see, this wonderful man is so good to me, and he gives to me so unconditionally. I really did not know a lot about unconditional love until I married Dave. And Dave just gives to me unconditionally, and he expects nothing back in return. But what I would do is I would put hooks on him. Because what the problem was is I had a problem accepting that kind of unconditional love. I didn't know how to do that. I did not know how to be loved unconditionally. And what I've learned about me is I have a lot of fears of intimacy. And I learned a lot about this because I'm not a person who disagrees with therapy. I very much agree with people getting help. I feel like because I am sober today and because I have been given this program, I have been given an open mind. And, you know, I may go try something and it doesn't work. But that's okay. I went and tried it. And some things work and some things don't. I always come back to the basics, which is my program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that people who have religious beliefs, the book talks about that. They said if you had a religious belief, but when you came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, most of us pick that up again, and we continue on. This is not the end-all, be-all, answer-all. This is a way to recover and get better so that we can be open to the world. The book says, please, be honest, open-minded, and willing. But sometimes I can do this myself. I can come into rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and sit here and become more rigid than the day I got here. Just putting blindfolders. This is the only way. This is the way. If you don't do it my way, you're wrong. And I have learned that maybe you're not wrong. Just maybe if I listen to you, you have something for me, if I'll just be open-minded. And these are the things that I've begun to learn since I've been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I have learned to accept love, and I didn't know how to do that. And what I was told one day is I am one of these people who runs around giving, 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 giving. And I got confronted. I have a wonderful AA sponsor who is so willing to be honest with me. And she said to me about 6 years ago, she said to me, Polly, you're so much fun and I love to be with you, but you always say yes when I ask you something and I'm never sure you mean it. And so I had to take a look at that because guess why Polly was saying yes? Because I needed for you to like me, and I needed for you to approve of me. And I didn't have the guts or the willingness to take a risk to tell you the truth. And thank God today I do. Because by doing that, by being honest and telling the truth, I take a risk of you, of your reaction, that you may not approve of me. So all these are just some ideas. Giving without having an expectation, being willing to be honest with ourselves and not fear, or maybe fear, but walk through the fear anyway of somebody else's reaction. And being willing to accept love as much as give it. You know, they say there's two kinds of alcoholics that come into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they're like the people who are real outgoing or really closed up. The yin and the yang, you know, there's always a yin and the yang. They talk about there's the people who are real milquetoast, and then there are their aggressors. And there's always a yin and a yang. Also, there are givers and takers. But what I have found out was, is I considered myself a giver, but what I was really doing was an undermined taking. It was a manipulation. And so what I try to do today is I try to give without having an expectation. And when I have learned to do that, the really neat thing, which I never could do before and I never could feel, is today I can receive. And I never ever could feel love because I couldn't receive it. But today I find if I give it for fun and for free, then I can receive it and I feel the love. And I'm not ashamed or embarrassed to let you do nice things for me. And I used to be embarrassed about that. If you did something nice for me, I had to go do something twice as nice for you just so I could stay even. Comments? Yes.
And you were starting to accept love. Did it feel painful and did you want to run away from it? You felt like you must try to take it in.
She says, when I first started to feel love, did it feel painful and it just felt like it was too much to take in? The answer is yes, and I'm not healed yet. Okay, these kind of weekends right now, the ladies here have given me, a beautiful gift, a big bouquet of flowers, a plane ticket to get here. And then there's just a thing inside of me that's just real embarrassed about that. You know, it's like, oh, my God, I've got to really be good. Look what they did. And so, I'd like to say that that's all healed, but it's not. And that I can, I can accept it better. I have two of the most gorgeous sons. And they just adore me. And they adore their wives. They are just very, very loving men. And sometimes I feel really guilty about when they do nice things for me. And we've got these two little Yorkies. And I mean, they are the cutest little puppies that you've ever laid eyes on. If you ever come to my house and you say anything different, you can't stay. And they are just so cute. They sleep in the bed with us. Julia's come and spent the night with me before when the guys were out. And I said, Julia, Rusty and Winston and Dusty Rose have to sleep in the bed with us. And Julia said, but I don't do dogs. I said, sorry. But this is, so when I go away, like Dave's gone this weekend and so am I get someone to take care of those puppies. Usually it's someone I sponsor and they'll come over and spend the weekend. Well, my oldest son has moved to California. So he said the other day I was having someone take care of the little dogs and he says, why didn't you ask me? And I said, well, I just didn't want to bother you to have to come over Lisa could stay there. And he says, but you didn't even ask. And he says, has it ever occurred to you, Mother, that it makes me feel really good to do nice things for you? And see, what I do by taking on and being the giver all the time is I deny the person that good feeling too, because it feels good to give. So the answer to your question is that here I stand 15 and a half years sober, and it's progress, not perfection. I am aware, so that's part of the battle, but it's not healed. And, I believe that God has the power to come down or come from wherever, because I believe he's everywhere. For me, that's how God, as I understand him, is just permeated through every woman in this room. And I know that he has the power to just, strike me perfect. I know that he has the power to do that. I just don't believe that's the way he works. I believe that I am given opportunities in which to grow by. And so I'm still in school. I'm still learning the lesson. It's still occurring. You're welcome. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
Well, go through your head before you get ready to give something and how you call yourself on it. You know that this is for fun or for free, or if this is for selfish reasons.
Okay. She says, how do I call myself on this and how do I know if it's for fun or for free or if it's for selfish reasons? Okay. What we're going to do in the next segment is we're going to do some inventory. And I'm going to show you how you figure that out. And it's very simple. We're going to do the four-step inventory, and what I do with the 10-step is I just do a mini version of that every time I have a problem, and I'm going to explain that to you in, when we start working on the steps. The steps are the answer. And I have found out, you know, we can, step 10 is continue to take personal inventory. So if I don't want to have to continue doing big step 4s and 5s, then I keep the house cleaned up in step 10. I've had to do some others because I let it get out of hand, but let the resentments build. Any other comments on Bill W.'s last letter? Please feel free. This is your workshop. Yes, ma'am.
In the first paragraph, it says, build maturity and balance. The development of much real maturity and balance, which is to say humility. Could you comment on that?
Yes, ma'am, I will. Let me just tell you my definition of humility. When I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not believe, I thought humility was being beaten down, humiliation. And what I learned was the definition of humility, and I believe it's Webster's definition, is to be teachable. And what I have learned by being humble is to be teachable. Now, a lot of times it feels really negative if somebody confronts me on an action and I don't want to listen or believe what they say. And you know, AA has been really good for me about that. You know, people get in my face and tell me the truth whether I want to hear it or not. But what happens is if I'm willing to be teachable, I can learn from that icky feeling. Ellen talks about pride and how pride stands in our way, and our book says that it's no mistake, or the 12 and 12, and the seven deadly sins, that pride leads the parade. Because what happens is I have to swallow my pride when I realize I am wrong. And to be, you know, Keith Lewis, I don't know if any of you have ever heard Keith speak. He says, it is a spiritual experience to say I'm wrong. That's so hard to do, but if I can say I'm wrong, then I can get freedom. No? To say I'm wrong?
Well, it is a spiritual experience when I say that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I can say I'm wrong. It's just movie.
Yeah. I mean, it takes everything inside of you. And that's humbling, and that's to be teachable. And it's balance. See, I think there's a guy in our group, and he's so precious. I love him. But he's one of these kind of people that he believes that you need to go to 2 meetings a day and be, you know, of service in every meeting. And I mean, he's very, very rigid. And if some newcomer is not going to, you know, 2 meetings a day, he goes up to that person and he says, you weren't in the meeting last night, or you weren't in the meeting this morning, and if you don't get to the meeting, you're going to get drunk. Well, I don't believe that's balance. Yet, see, again, it's those blinders. Now, that may be what he needs to do for him, but I don't know that that's necessarily what everybody needs to do. So what I try to find and what I've been trying to do is maturity and balance, and I think those words are synonymous because there seems to be balance when there's maturity. I think childlike behavior is blindfolders and not being able to see the whole thing, not to be humble, not to be teachable. Did I answer the question? His last letter. Now, let me just tell you what has happened in other... I read this letter in another organization that was not necessarily Alcoholics Anonymous. There were some recovering people in there. And a lot of people felt very offended by Bill's letter. They felt like it was being subservient, a doormat. So the difference is that when we're in touch with spiritual maturity, it truly is better to give than to receive. But it is just as necessary to be able to receive as it is to give. Yes, ma'am.
In my
myself, I learned that I'm a person of faith, and that you sort of characterization of people in AA, and I think it's true in Alma too, of the sort of receptive tie to the one that's out there, right? But you know, at some point, I had to get off my need to have an adrenaline rush.
Mm-hmm. What she is saying is that there's both kinds of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, but that you had to get off your knee to have an adrenaline rush all the time. And I think that's it, because that intensity. I mean, when I was at a woman-to-woman in Arkansas, one of the best workshops we had was adrenaline, my drug of choice. You know, and it was like, wow, that's it. It's that rush. What I can remember, my sickness of when in early sobriety, it's like, you know, I wasn't sneaking around with alcohol and drugs anymore, trying to go to this doctor and that doctor. And the next thing I'm doing is that I end up having a bunch of affairs in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll guarantee you your adrenaline will rush with that. And it's like you start, you know, it's just having the need to stop having that excitement all the time. Living on the edge. True. Okay. This is it. What do we do? Okay, the question is, Terry on the tape here. So I'm going to give you, now I can't always do this, okay, Jewel, but this is what I believe our program tells us. She says, what do we do for a substitution for that adrenaline rush? Well, the better relationship I have with my higher power, the less I need to be stoned on something all the time. And I know that that's the answer. I can't always walk the mark, but I know for me that that's the answer. That's why I believe the 12 steps will work for anything. And all I have to do is where it says we were powerless over alcohol, is I can put in whatever it is that is my drug of choice that month. Now, I want to give you all this little thing. Julia will love this because I haven't told her yet. Because we were talking about her excursions in Europe. But my drug of choice right now is shopping. I love to shop. I'll tell you what, if I can walk into a store and I can find a Liz Claiborne blouse that was $65, marked down to $40, and half of that, and I get it for $20, I am stoned. I have got a rush. I love it. I feel like I have just walked into that store, found that garment, and I'm just as excited as if I were shot up with heroin. And what I do today is one day at a time, I pray to God as I understand Him that I am powerless over shopping. And I have not been in a mall for 40 days. And that is a big deal. So I've got to start, I've got to go Christmas shopping. But what I've got to do is make a list so that, and we're talking about selfish and self-centered, so that I buy things for the people on my list instead of for Polly. Yes.
One of the things I've realized that I really am dependent on attention. And doing some writing about that is why do I need attention? Because if I was dependent on negative attention, it turns out, it's as if I don't exist. If I'm not being noticed, it's like I'm not there.
Mm-hmm.
And giving without something, there's no validation. It's like I don't exist, and I think that's just a place I am. But I don't know if that's what Joe Billy was talking about. Being dependent on, I mean, I know there's some kind of dependence on others for something there, but it's kind of a reason.
What she's talking about is that she says that she needs to, that she is dependent on attention, and that you need to have the attention of others or you feel like you're invisible. Is that correct? I absolutely, totally identify. And that's what I was talking about when I was addicted to approval. I needed you to validate my very existence, because without you validating me, I didn't exist. And I don't know if there's any other people who have had this experience, but if you, for me, it was as real as it could be. I could look in a mirror and see nothing. I could not see my face. I could not see me. I would look in a mirror and there was nothing there. That is how invisible I was. I didn't exist. If you didn't pay attention to me, I could not walk alone anywhere. Because if I did, I didn't exist. And it was almost as if I was just going to disappear. And that was how I felt. I have learned today, thanks to some wonderful people and being willing to share it, just like you did, I was willing to share it, that they told me that that people, places, or things cannot make me feel as if I belong. But my relationship with my higher power can. Because unless I'm connected with that relationship, then I can't feel it. The only way that I know how to move from that emptiness of no relationship to a relationship is through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I must work those steps, and through those steps, I will experience a spiritual awakening and begin to feel the fulfillment of the Spirit within me. Yes, Sue Ellen.
What you're talking about here, I had a lot of help with. I was very fortunate early to early and I worked with a new conflict counselor in self-recovery. And she begged me to write a book called New Guide to National Living, Robert. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not. But he calls the same thing that we're calling emotional and mental, he calls rational and motive. And as alcoholics or as compulsive personalities, we come completely from the emotional.
Mm-hmm.
When we're our tickets, we're completely coming out of the emotional. And the recovery process for me has been to bring the two together so that they are in some kind of a balance.
Mm-hmm.
And she called it, the conference I called it, Pass Back. When you can begin to feel that you're coming from both places equally. We can allow the people, you can also listen to the rational, and we have enough sobriety to enough freedom, you know, sobriety, that we have that pause. We can think before we act, think before we speak. And that's that growing.
The maturity.
That's the maturity. That's the beautiful. It's the effort, it's the effort.
Mm-hmm. Sue Ellen is talking about, this is for the benefit of, so we can tape it, Sue Ellen, that you're talking about, you know, getting the head and the gut in line with some kind of rationality, and that's a lifetime to do that, because I have been governed by my emotions, or I have been governed by my intellect. It seemed like the balance of the two I either was totally in my head or coming totally from my feelings. And both places are irrational. Is that right? And trying to get those two things in line and to be in harmony is the thing that we do that takes a lifetime. Did I pretty much sink that? Great. Because I agree. One of the things I learned when I first came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is the longest walk in this program is the 18 inches between my head and my heart. Is to get those two things in line. Because I need to be able to think before I act. And I also need to be able to have feelings and emotions. The problem is when either one of those things rule me. Is when they totally are in control. Now, you can come into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you can find people that are totally in their head and haven't had a feeling in 50 years. And you can have other people who come in here totally neurotic, and they haven't had a thought in 50 years. All they've had is a feeling. And on either extreme is self-destructive. So that's, we need to, so we'll just spend the rest of our lives just kind of walking it in. I'm going to kind of get close to you, so, because you've got some good things that you're saying, and I'm not repeating them as well as you're saying them.
Well, I just want to say too that the other part of the lesson, and the part that was so hard for me to accept, is that that premise that I am responsible for my feelings. And you said this last night, and all my problems are my making.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I'm different from other women that are here who drank to feelings. I mean,
mm-hmm.
circumstances and people and all of that, it all really came down to feelings. I drank to those feelings. And once I could accept that no one could make me feel angry or resentful or sad or whatever, then I could begin to get well.
Mm-hmm. Stop being a victim.
Right. They are my feelings. I create them. I have a choice how I respond. Life is problematic. People, places, and things
mm-hmm.
will always have problems with them. That's life.
That's right.
My response is my choice. That's what we're here about. And you are wonderfully articulate about that. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. Go ahead.
And I knew it all the time about your other addiction, so you were.
Oh, sorry. We're codependent in that. That's right. I tell you, codependent in that one.
I didn't hear what Julia said.
Julia said that I knew about your other addiction all the time. You weren't hiding it. My shopping addiction, you guys might not have known that. But I had some help. You know, I used to go find, you know how when you go drink and you go to bars and you find people to drink with? I found people to shop with. Come go with me. I'll show you how to spend $300 in 30 minutes. So, but it's, you know, it's real hard because the next thing you know you don't have any money. And that's like no fun. We were talking, I want to kind of talk again about what Sue Ellen was talking about taking responsibility. We're going to talk more of that in the steps, but it's also about emotional sobriety. And one of the things that, you know, is a lot of us are children. We're somebody's child, or we wouldn't be here tonight. And a lot of the women here are mothers. So we've got both aspects of having the hurts of being, you know, having childhood hurts, and then have hurt a child. And one of the things that the way that I was finally able to take total responsibility for the things that happened to me as a child was when I was able to get some healing with what I had done as a mother. And what happened was I was finally able to say to my children, and I was able to own, because children are victims. 5, 6-year-old or however old a child is does not have a choice of what's happening in their life because they are children. The big people are telling them what to do, how to do it. And these little bitty kids do not have choices. That's, as far as I'm concerned, they are at our mercy. And what I was able to do with my kids was I was able to say, all your problems have my name on them, but all your solutions have yours. So that I can take responsibility what I did as an abusive parent, but I can do nothing for this child's solution. And today I know that what I am at 52 years old, if I'm still carrying around the same stuff that happened to me as a child, then what is happening is I am still reacting to that situation like a child. I have to begin to heal as an adult, and that is not easy because some people have traumatic things that happen to them as children. So it becomes a really big undertaking. You know, what an order. I can't go through with it. But what happens is if I'm willing to go in and heal that, then I can begin to react to those situations as an adult instead of as a child. And I can stop parent bashing. Because today I truly believe that the world is in perfect order. Even though it may not be in my order, it's in perfect order. And that the lessons that we have different lessons. And some of them are so traumatic. And I'm not always set free from that. You know, I can get back into, you know, the things that happened with me because there's a lot of things that I took on and a lot of old ideas that stay back in my head that are things that I formulated as a child. And that's, you know, and we you know, our formative years, we do formulate things as a child. And I continue to react as an adult from those child thoughts. So what becomes the emotional sobriety for me today in the maturity is to learn to react to things that go on inside of me as a middle-aged woman instead of a 5-year-old child. And I'm telling you, sometimes that's what an order. I can't go through with it. And, you know, it's like the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that alcohol is but a symptom. We have to get down to the causes and conditions. And I was just reading in step 9 this morning in the big book, and it talks about that the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. And it's in one of those little wiggly words, you know, that italicized. And as Joe and Charlie always say, if it's italicized in the big book, you better pay attention to it. So, okay. It's a few minutes after 10. If you need to get up and take a break, do. But I want to go on with the rest of it because if not, we're going to run out of time. This always happens to me that I just end up running out of time. Okay, if you've got pencil and paper, if you don't, you can see me later, and we're going to do some 4-step stuff. If you don't have a pencil and paper, that's okay. I can talk with you later. It's all in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I'm going to talk about when it comes to inventory, this is in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have tried to do it other ways, and for me, this is what works. And I think probably the best teachers that are around right now on the big book is Joe and Charlie. And if you haven't heard some tapes on Joe and Charlie's Big Book Comes Alive, or if you've not experience a seminar with them, I highly encourage you to do that because it's really great. The big book talks about 3 inventories, a resentment inventory, a fear inventory, and a sex inventory. And it's real important that we do all 3 inventories. Sex. I'm sure all you nice ladies don't have any idea what that's about. All of us sitting here are virgins, right? Okay, the way that I have the women that I work with do it is if you've got a spiral notebook, is I'm just going to use this is think of this as a spiral notebook opened up. You know how you open it up? And I have them draw a line down each page, because what you're going to want is four columns. Okay? Now, at the top of each column, you might write, at the first column, I am resentful at. Or if it's easier for you to say, I am angry at. I am angry at Mom. I am angry at Dad. I'm angry at God. Whatever. And a lot of us, I mean, be honest. Just be willing to just go for it and be honest. The next column is, what is the cause? Why am I angry? Am I angry at my mom because she never paid any attention to me? She was always more concerned about Dad. She never had any time, or, you know, what any of this stuff is. Yeah, this is a bigger version. He's got it typed out in a bigger version than Joe and Charlie have it. Thanks, Terry. So if we can get a copy machine, you know, you guys, because this is a bigger version of it. And it's just really, the reason I have them do four columns is where you have more writing space. So the second column is the cause. Now, the third column affects, what does it affect? It affects my, this is all in the big book, but you can write it down because it's right there for you to work with. My self-esteem, personal relationships, material, emotional, acceptable sex relationships, hidden sex relationships, social, security, and sexual. Okay, now, let me just put down the four things that these categories go under. Okay, self-esteem and personal relationships is your social instinct, okay? Material and emotional is your security instinct. Terry, I got this thing and it won't stay up. I goofed it up. The sex instinct is acceptable sex and hidden sex. My ambition is social, is what's socially accepted, the security, and sexual. What are my social ambitions? What are my security ambitions? I'm sorry. And my sexual ambitions. If you can't get these written, then I've got copies. So you can, you know, come write them down if I go too fast. Okay, do it again. Okay, the first column is I am resentful at. Everybody got that?
Yeah.
The cause. Okay, now it affects my, and you've got four categories that it's going to affect. The first is my social instinct, and under social instinct is going to be my self-esteem and my personal relationships. The next instinct is my security instinct. And under my security instinct is going to be material and emotional. Then comes my sex instinct, acceptable and hidden. When these are relationships, some people feel like it's acceptable to have a sex relationship with a person, but it's a hidden relationship to have it with a dog. So, if you want a kind of a definition. Is that clear? Julia says a unicorn sounds better. Okay, then we come to ambitions, and that's Under ambitions, it's going to be social, security, and sexual. Categories underneath those. Okay, we got four categories. Social instinct, self-esteem, and personal relationships. The next one is security instinct, and that's under material, and under that's material and emotional. Then sex instinct, and that's acceptable and hidden. And the fourth is ambition, and that's social, security, and sexual. A social ambition, an ambition that's security, like your job, work, money, and then sexual, you know. Okay, yeah, you can, and it's up here, and you can write off that. I also have Joe and Charlie's. This is the same thing, except Terry has it bigger, so you can see it bigger. So you're welcome to come up and use these, so not to worry. If you can't get them fast enough, don't worry. Okay. No, that's not the fourth column. That affects my. You know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says it affects my social instinct, my security instinct, my sex instinct, or my ambition. Okay, that's what the book says. Then you go to the fourth column, and that's the nature of my wrong. And I like to say, what's my part in it? And that's my nickname around my Monday night group, because somebody will come up to me and they've got this big problem, and I'll say to them, have you taken a look at your part in it? So now it's like one of the girls that I sponsor, she says, I already know that I come to talk to you about something. It's going to be, what's your part in it? Yes. Hidden. So, well, like wanting to have an affair with your boss, maybe that's an ambition. That might be, you know, a negative ambition. Or it's like having an ambition to have a relationship with a man who's single, handsome, wonderful. That's an ambition. There's nothing wrong with that. Or it can be wrong if he's married. Or if he's 10. So, okay? It all depends. It's a yin and a yang thing again. This is an inventory, all right? Okay, and the fourth column is what's my part in it. Okay, and we're going to have four things. Was I selfish? In other words, was I self-seeking in this relationship? Okay, and all in this sexual ambition, was I self-seeking? Was I wanting to be satisfied without giving anything in return? Was I willing to go after another woman's husband and not even look at the consequences just so I could have self-gratification? Was I dishonest? Did I tell a lot of lies? Mm-hmm. Okay, selfish is the first one. Dishonest. The next one is self-seeking and frightened. And I usually just use, you know, was I afraid? And the fourth is inconsiderate. And if you're having any problems, don't worry about getting all this written down because it's right here. So you can come up here and write it down. And if you see it, it'll probably be easier for you. If you can, I should have made copies of this. This is great, Terry, to have the big one, you know. This was so little, but I could have certainly made copies of this, so I apologize. No. Thank you. I made a mistake today. I'm doing enough. Okay. All three inventories are the same, okay? They use the same thing, except the fear inventory is going to be, I am afraid of, what's the cause? And the sex inventory is going to be, I have harmed, and how did I harm them? Now, one of the things that I try to make is clear. Oh my goodness, look at all this. This is even a bigger one. It just doesn't have the categories marked down. So we'll have these, we can pass these out too. And then what you can do is you can come up here and where it says affects my, you can write all this stuff in here, that's in here, on there. And then you'll have a go by. I should have, like, I just didn't. Sorry, guys, but we've got it. I'm going to apologize anyway. Thank you. Okay. Higher power did it. There must be a copying machine on the premises. If there is, this is room to write on, and this is the directions. So we'll see to it before the day is out that you have these. Okay, we're going to have inventory sheets here. So that's going to be great. Okay, now, one of the things that I like to make clear in the sex inventory, because it becomes really hard for the women who have been sexually abused, all right? There are women in here who have had some very traumatic sexual abuse. Now, sometimes because of that, you know, one of the things that I've learned is that every victim becomes an offender. Whatever the victimization is, then the victim is the victim becomes an offender. Now, what may have happened is I may have harmed someone sexually, but my own sexual abuse is not what I'm talking about, okay? I may be resentful. That might be on my resentment list about who did that to me. And a lot of times when my part comes, where it comes to sexual and real child abuse and physical abuse, my part in it may be no part. Because children do not have a choice in that kind of thing. What could you do? So remember that. Because a lot of times what happens to people is I think they are made to be responsible for that behavior and what happened. And I want to clarify that. I do not believe that a child is responsible for that. But as an adult, I believe that I am responsible for my reaction to that. Now, is that clear? Because a lot of times we come in here and well-meaning sponsors end up putting more shame on us than we already have. She says, say it again. I am not responsible for the child abuse that happened to me as a child. Now, I may have those people on my resentment list. If it's sexual abuse, a lot of people think that it ought to be on the sex inventory. In my opinion, it does not belong there. It belongs on the resentment inventory because I didn't harm anyone sexually as a child. I was a victim. But if I harm someone as an adult as a result of that abuse, for that I am responsible. Now, the other thing is that a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous are made to feel ashamed and responsible that as a child they had something to do with that. No, you did not, in my opinion. Now, this is what I believe. Have anything to do with that. But what I am responsible for is my reaction to that as an adult. And that's what we're going to inventory, and that's what we're going to take responsibility for. And by taking responsibility for my reactions to what happened to me, I can heal. But it's a big leap in faith because it's a big willingness to go take a look. But we can heal. Is that clear? That's a real hard issue. But I just feel like that so many women are made to feel shame by well-meaning people in Alcoholics Anonymous, to make them feel like what happened to them as a child is their fault. It is not your fault. We were victims. Okay. Things that I've done. It's that in a sex inventory, it's people I have harmed sexually. That's what the book says. It's about the people I have harmed. Now, a lot of that may be as a result of my anger and all of that from sexual abuse, but those are people I have harmed. I don't know about any of you, but I have used a lot of men to get things I wanted. And I gave them sex, it was no big deal. I didn't think. But a lot of things I got that way, I paid 100 times for, spiritually and emotionally. Okay. Did I make myself clear? The book says, I have harmed people I have harmed. Let me see exactly what Joe and Charlie say here on the inventory. Okay, the first column is, who did I harm? And the sex column. It didn't say, who harmed me? It says, who did I harm? Who harmed me goes in the resentment list. I'm angry with that. Okay, that's the resentment list. Column two is, what did I do? And then all of the instincts are the same. That always remains the same. Joe and Charlie are two guys that do big book seminars. And I know Terry would know their last names, but they're two guys and they go around and they do big book seminars. And most every taper has tapes. Here comes Terry with a box of tapes to show you what they look like. They are excellent, absolutely excellent. And they talk about the big book comes alive. This is a 1992 big book study, Joe and Charlie. This was done in North Vancouver, B.C. And if any of you, I put these tapes in my car. I drive around and listen to them because I don't know about you, but my memory doesn't hold all the time. So what I do is repetition strengthens and confirms, and faith then comes naturally. That's what the book says. I have to hear it over and over and over, and it just makes the big book come alive for me. I have a better understanding of the big book. So I just highly encourage you, if you've never, you know, done anything with these tapes, to do it. It has made it so clear to me. And inventories, it's like now today, inventories, amends, we're going to talk about that, are clear. But you may, you know, forget what I say this weekend. And this goes through the whole part of the big book. Bill's story, Dr. Silkworth, his letter, yeah. So... yes, Terry? 5 minutes. Okay. Now, when all of this is written down and we do this inventory, the first thing we do is do just like the book says, the step says, admit it to God, to myself, and to another person. Now, what is the first one? Admitted to God. And here's the rub I hear a lot of times, and I said the same thing. God already knows. That's not what it says. God already knows. It says admitted to God.